This is After Dark, X Spaces version, and today we wanted to kind of focus on topics around political intrigue and flashback storytelling. We had some of that happen with some recent episodes, and actually, you know, we've been doing this for a little while, but I thought it'd be appropriate to kind of cover these topics today, Angel, and then talk a little bit about, you know, other things that we can talk about regarding that. So, for those who are new here, I'm Corey Siegel. I'm the CEO of Darkport, but really I'm kind of here hosting this space to provide education and talk about TTRPG themes and really everything around actual play. That's kind of the purpose of After Dark. And with us, we have my co-founder and creative officer and wonderful GM, Angel Gamble, here. And say hi, Angel.
Howdy, everybody.
Great. And he's going to be a lot of, he's basically my co-host, and together we are going to have a fireside chat if we're, you know, kind of a small group here. And if we get people in here that ask and want to participate and discuss, that's even better. So with that, I wanted to tackle a little bit about, Angel, regarding flashback storytelling, tell me, you know, kind of your thoughts around that and kind of your choices on when you do it and why. And there might be specific reasons why you do it for Darkport specifically, but in general, give us a little idea about the purpose behind it, or at least in your mind, and how to effectively utilize that tool.
Right. So there are a couple different things to say about this. One of them is we're talking specifically about tabletop role-playing games. It's a different thing. I'm also a writer, so it's a different thing if you're writing. Basically, as a writer, and this is still largely true with TTRPGs, but there are more exceptions to this, you really have to be careful with flashbacks, because anytime that you're going back in the narrative, the forward momentum is well, I won't say dying, but it's not as great. It's kind of a drag on it. There are very few authors who handle flashbacks perfectly. James Clavell would be one of them, who wrote Shogun. The rest of the Asian saga. He's really about the only person I've seen who is aware of exactly how much you can depart from the forward motion of the narrative. Now, having said that, TTRPGs are a little bit different in that it's a kind of a live play. It's, you know, collaborative. It's all real time, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's the further complication of a streaming game. So in a home game, and when Corey's talking about flashbacks, flashback storytelling, he's specifically talking about the players playing characters in a former era, or players playing characters when they are not in the current moment in the main campaign, to be perfectly clear. Let's assume that you are doing a historical flashback, like you're doing the generation before, or it may be the same characters, but you're doing like a deep cut on their Constructed Chaos has done this actually recently. You're doing you're playing them through a childhood event. I think there it can be really powerful, because you know these characters already, you're invested in these characters already, and you want this deeper history on them. Doing a historical, although you'd still use them largely the same way, that's a smaller scope because you're not trying to tell about a new era in history that hasn't been seen before. You're just weaving a tale about this particular character. I think once the forward momentum of the narrative is well established, as it is in their campaign, as it is in our campaign, I think then it's okay. I think you can go back. Alex doesn't do entire sessions like that. Constructed Chaos's GM and our good friend doesn't do entire sessions like that, but he'll do chunks. He'll definitely do chunks. I think the one with Jerzad was maybe 20 minutes, maybe even longer. Might have even been okay. Longer than that. It was a good vignette, you know. And it was him as a kid, and you got to see why this Dragonborn child wound up studying with a bunch of dwarves for years. I mean, it was, you know, kind of an unusual situation, even in his world where it'd be a little bit more common. For us, there are a couple different additional factors. So you always have the exigencies of scheduling. And I
always
wanted, my God. So I always wanted an ongoing, germane, deep plot thread that could be happening when one or more players was out.
So I think it's a great idea, especially in live play where you really don't have a choice.
No.
Pre-recorded, you can sort of stay ahead of the game and maybe have three or four episodes, you know, in the pipeline or whatever. But yeah, with live stream, you got to have.
maybe you can. We're gonna see as we launch you know, Curse of Strahd, right? We do, you know, and that's, you know, that's been a long-term conversation, but I do think the live play is, I think it's special. I think it makes us special. I think the performances are crisper. I know I'm more on my toes. You know, it's easier to stay in that mental space, et cetera, et cetera. But there is more pressure too, you know.
There's more pressure
if our co-founder and, you know, producer Justin was here, he would, you know, could talk about that, and we should have him on sometime.
Definitely.
But I wanted, and with the kind of story that I'm telling and the kind of narrative that we're all kind of driving, it's so big and it's so like very much rooted in the generations that came before. Mm-hmm. That telling an involved tale about a previous era with a culture that y'all are going to be dealing with soon, that you kind of already have. You've nibbled around the edges because one of your members is half Uralit, is, you know, half part of that culture.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to really expand and tie the current events into a framework and into a historical context. I also have a degree in history, so it, you know, like I'm think of myself as an armchair historian. You know, I try to understand the moments that we're in, and the previous moments. And so that was it's challenging, because you're doing this huge amount of world building. You're basically trying to flesh out an entire other section removed by both geography, although not that far. I think you figured out basically where you're at, Corey. Not removed that much, but by geography and by time. Of course, the danger in this is that you spend, from a GM perspective, you spend too much time and energy doing this kind of side project, and you know, George R. R. Martin yourself into writing books, these side books, and the main narrative, you know, doesn't, you know, he's doing God's work and he's produced a masterpiece, but, you know, I hope it can get finished. Maybe a Robert Jordan situation. Yeah, hopefully not, but could happen that way.
Yeah.
Where Sanderson had to come in and basically finish the job. That's one danger. And then from a player perspective, it's, you know, confusing the players and kind of muddying the waters. But y'all are such strong players. I'm not personally worried about that.
Even the viewers, you get this momentum, right? Like, we literally, like right now, we had the second episode of a final arc going on, and sure, we're in this critical scene and this great battle, this great fight, and we're coming towards like the last, at least the second half of the arc, where now Borealis is finally on the playing field, and then it's paused, and people are like, the momentum is there, and people are excited to see the next, what's going to happen next, and then we need to switch back to flashback. And it's, again, it's part of the live stream, guys. It's a challenge, but
It is. Then the alternative, and we've done this before, you know, and I think we've done it reasonably successfully, is the alternative is showing, is doing interviews and, you know, doing one-off stuff. But I think this way, at least if you take the Age of Tuscotli episodes, the flashback episodes as a whole, they will tell a coherent story.
No, I love it. I think people want to watch more show. And so you're just doing the offshoot kind of in parallel, Angel. Even though it's not, you know, it wouldn't necessarily, timing wise, it may not be perfect. I think it's better than the interview stuff.
Yeah, it's not ideal. But, you know, Donnie was out of state, then Allie's out of state. You know, it's just, it's hard, you know, and the thing that I have to remind myself, Corey, about this when I'm really kind of, you know, down on myself or down on, you know, just the difficulties that we're facing is like, we're doing, like, we all have full-time jobs, you know, like we all have lives, we all have things that we're doing. This is not, you know, we're inevitably, well, any like up and coming streaming situation is going to be inevitably compared to the juggernaut, which is Critical Role. That's, you know, that's no mystery. But that is their life. You know, they have this incredible, and I think Matt Mercer would be the first person to agree with this. They have this incredible privilege of just pouring everything that they are, if they want to, into,
yeah,
let me phrase, pouring everything that they are into this, you know, amazing creation that they've made, no doubt. And then they can take whatever project they feel like, you know, outside of that. And for us, it's like, this has to fit into Donnie's business plans. This has to fit into Allie's modeling schedule. This has to fit into Tatiana's traveling schedule. This has to, you know, fit into your traveling schedule and your tournaments. And, you know, like, it's,
yeah,
this is all, I mean, you know, my God, you know, Justin has, you know, a whole family, mm-hmm, that, you know,
that we no, have no, to, like, it's that transition period, right? It's a growing up period where we're too small. We can't make this a full-time thing. So how do you manage this? But how do you also grow and still also, and I think you're doing a great job, and I think we are handling it very well. And I hope the viewers think so as well, because that's what really matters, is the viewers. But in terms of sort of allowing us to be able to produce something of quality and consistency and entertainment while still having most people have, you know, these full-time jobs.
You know, it's one of the reasons why I pushed so hard to get the cathedral model up on the table and to have the action shots with the cameras and everything. And I mean, that was that specific approach. That was Justin, and that was us looking at Constructed Chaos and saying, okay, how can we translate this, you know?
Right.
But I wanted to really punch it up for the finale, for the story arc finale. You know, I really wanted to embody this critical sacred place. You know, of course, the last finale we did the battle of the Broken Tower, now, mm-hmm, Aurelia's Watch, and that was the most elaborate set piece we had done up to that point. And I think it holds up. I think it looks really good, but I wanted to refine that, and I wanted to really have something that would linger in the imagination. And I mean, how many comments did we get, Corey? How much positive feedback did we get for that set piece?
Oh no. Yeah. I mean, if at some point when we have the ability, that will be a reoccurring thing once we have the budget and time and yes, money. And as we grow, yes, and we have people that are wonderful people that donate to allow us to produce this sort of stuff. Cause this for everyone's, yes, folks, every dollar that goes in here is going right back into production, and therefore the higher quality value and the minis and the sets and the stuff, you know, this stuff isn't free.
Yeah. So, it's all, no, I mean, it all takes money to keep the lights on, you know?
Exactly.
So
to kind of bring this back, so it sounds like on the flashback side, there are a couple of, I mean, outside of writing's a whole separate thing, but let's say within just the actual plays, space,
mm-hmm, yes,
there is ability to when players are gone or tell a larger arc, a kind of parallel arc, there's that theme, that way of doing things. And then I guess I predict or foresee, Angel, at some point in the future, at the right times, you're going to flash back to people's history and do a 20-30 minute whatever vignette around that to be able to enhance whatever that scene's about to happen, or what happened in that scene and why it occurred. So I see that's a second technique around flashbacks to sort of give backstory.
Both of those both of those are there. I'm actually Corey, I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly could, and I can see the value of it. As far as flashing back to individuals, that's it's not something you would do to, like, you know, cover because Donnie's out of state, obviously, because it's just something, you know, it's more of like, it's more of an additive.
Or to explain something to someone that's not really, you know, apparent on why decisions were made or why this was given. Yeah.
And it's a little bit hard because we do have so much actual filmed history of these characters, mm-hmm. but we don't have that up because the quality wasn't what we decided. And we may eventually make that, you know, a member's thing.
I'll give you an example, and this is not actually filmed, but this is because I know about this, but maybe there might be a 10-minute flashback of me with the patriarch of Pulux when I meet him face to face the next time, or something happens. I'm not saying that should happen. I'm just saying there's scenes like that where there's got to be history about why there's hatred there. There's a little bit of that on screen right now, but there wasn't, for example. And the same thing with, or what happened with Marcus and that situation. And with that's not Leptis Minor. What was his name? Angel, help me out here.
Oh, what, for Sextus?
Sextus Minor, yeah. Sextus. So the kid, and even a flashback of how the kid was before he grew up. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but those are just things that you can. I was thinking of one example. There might be some things around, you know, the brother and Tatiana's character to help set that stage too. Who knows?
You know what? I did. I have to correct myself. I didn't even think about it because it was so natural. I just kind of spontaneously did I don't know, it was 3 minutes, 4 minutes. It was very brief, but I wanted to establish that Marcus and his wife Alba would lie down on one of the few rolling hills around Pulux. And in these rare moments of peace, you know, when all of their kids and all of the, you know, the nieces and nephews and, you know, everybody was attended to, that they would actually sit, they would lie down they'd lie down next to each other and they'd play games at looking at the clouds, you know, and they decide what these different clouds were. I remember doing that. I offhand, I can't remember what episode that was in.
With Anika, with Adrian, he didn't do like a flashback per se, but his drawings gave some history of previous stuff, you know, through that perspective.
Sure. Yeah. No, there are all kinds of ways that you can, I guess, you know, it's funny. I wouldn't have put it this way before, Corey, but now that you're like, kind of pointing these examples out, I'm thinking about how important it is to me as a storyteller, as a game master, to convey a sense of history and depth. It's really important to me. I think, you know, part of that is that's just a natural proclivity for me, and then part of that is as a reaction to so many games where you don't really have a you just spring fully formed from Zeus's head, you know, as the adventuring party. Like you don't know your parents' name. You have no siblings. You've never had any, you know, loves before. I mean, et cetera, which is of course absurd because that's not how humans no human is that.
Right.
No human is that. One other thing I wanted to say about, a consideration of using flashback, like big full flashback episodes, is you really have to be very clear with the audience because you're now twice removed. It's from my head to the players, and that's always an ongoing conversation and issue. And sometimes people get frustrated and sometimes it works perfectly and like that. But then you have to be able to continue the story to people who are watching this who don't have the benefit of being in the room and who can ask clarifying questions. So it's really, really important. Like I did something last session that I would never have done in a home game, which as I said, okay, Randy, roll to see how effective your fomenting desertion has been.
Right. Yeah.
Because that tells everybody at that table that Randy's character has been running around encouraging desertion. And of course that then tells you that he's actually not, despite anything that he ever says, he's actively trying to undermine Ocatla, probably trying to kill her, and has his whole own suite of motivations.
Oh yeah. And we're going to get to that in the political side here in a second for sure. And, yeah, definitely.
but that's like really important. I would say that if you're doing these flashback episodes and the audience doesn't have at least the advantage of like the steep history and being with these characters for 30, 40, 50 episodes, so that you really do understand when somebody's acting out of place or like that, that you have to be more upfront and just trust that the players aren't going to metagame. You know, like the clarity, I guess this is the last thing I'll say on this, but this has been a really important one because we're talking about streaming games specifically. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I have learned to prize, and that has been quite a shift for me as a game master. And you know this because you've been gaming with me for years and years. I've had to become much more open about what is happening and learn to prize clarity over subterfuge. And sometimes, mm-hmm. even though it hurts my Scorpio heart, over subtlety. It sometimes it really hurts.
Angel loves his secrets.
it really hurts because they're supposed to unfold over years of play, and instead you just have to throw something out there because otherwise you risk losing somebody who's watching. And again, they can't just say, "Hey, what's going on?" or "Did I miss something?" or whatever. It's like, "No, you didn't miss something." That actually is just just an incongruity. And then they can tug on that thread, but you can't do that. So anyway,
would you, if we had a perfect schedule and no players missed a session, would there be flashbacks? Would there be a second? Would there be a H. Tetz Kotli? And at what point would there be? Or is that something that would be just a second show, a second episode of kind of a little mini arc that we would produce and then put out later?
I have thought about this, and I think what I would probably do in a perfect world, if no episodes were missed and this was somebody's, everybody's thriving full-time job, right? I would say I would still want this history. Like, I've always planned for this history to come out because we need to know certain things. And if you've been paid, especially last session, there were already a lot of tie-ins.
Mm-hmm.
And without spoiling anything for the current moment, it would seem like I'm just pulling things out of my rear end if things just showed up all of a sudden and you as a player had never played through any of these things. You'd be like, "What is he doing? This is like some Deus Ex Machina crap," you know? So what I would probably do is I would take, and of course our whole shooting schedule would be different, right? What I would do is I would take like every sixth episode or something like that,
mm-hmm.
but it would be part of the regularly scheduled thing.
Okay.
Or when we were on like a true break, because we'd probably only have one, maybe two hiatuses in a year. But when we were like on a true break, I would see who could commit to filming, and maybe it'd only be four of us or something, but I would just get those players. I'd play the rest as NPCs. And then we would have like you said, we'd have a proper mini campaign.
Yeah.
We do like four dedicated sessions and then another. And then by the time it was time for this information to like come out and it had to be out there, then I would string together everything we'd done and probably be, I'm just pulling this out, Corey. So,
No, and it's if you're talking like Angel,
sessions. Be like 12 sessions or something like that.
It's hard. I mean, and it's your position, so I don't envy you. But it's hard to figure out. Like, I think to really for people to understand certain situations, whether it's like where the weapon came from, where did Winter's mm-hmm. Harvest come from, mm-hmm. the history behind it, the blood,
really
the sweat,
really important.
How did the culture come about? I don't know this, but like PTSD or torture and what, I'm not sure if that needs to be communicated, but what is that really like? So how do people really understand what someone's been through to what happened with, Anika's character and her father? And so the question, mm-hmm. and I go on and on here, but the question is what stories, when to tell them so that the audience, so the character that's being played, people really start to understand the character. They'll understand them from moving forward, obviously,
but they will understand what the core elements that may have happened to them in the past that has driven them to make those decisions until they're like, oh my God, that's what happened. That's why he's been acting that way. Mm-hmm. Or, oh my God. So those things get kind of missed unless you insert them. And it's a challenge because you can't do everything at once. So how do you handle that?
You have to be, because it's not like it can just pull you off to the side, Corey, and say, hey, show up half an hour early and we'll game through, blah, 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 you know? I don't want to say regimented because I do have flexibility, but like you're so beholden to producing a quality product, which is a privilege. Let me be clear. Mm-hmm. It's a privilege, but it is still a duty, you know? And so I can't just do whatever the hell I feel like that session.
Right.
And I have to be very intentional about not just what we're doing as a group, but also the time of everybody else. Like you might have more time than Tatiana does, or Randy might have time. Cause I live with Randy. So it's like, I can, you know, Randy can't get away from me. So I may be able to game through, you know, something with him that I can't necessarily with Allie, who, you know, lives, who has to drive an hour and a half, et cetera. But I would say that the crux of the answer there, like the core of the answer is I have learned to be increasingly efficient. And I've had to be very selective about the things that I decide rise to the level of must be seen on stream. This goes for the main episodes, and this also goes for the adjunct, you know, the adjunct things. I'm just going to point out Concord, which is the divine, which is the weapon that Donnie's character now has, mm-hmm. is a divine creation. So mm-hmm. you don't really need that much of an origin story, and it's already has a hell of a history. Winter's Harvest. I mean, I don't think this is a spoiler. That ain't a divine thing. That is
no.
a creation of man.
No, but I, even with Concord, you got a little bit of the history behind Concord
you did.
Yeah.
So you did. And that's probably all you're going to get, you know, like unless Donnie, like really, unless he, and you know, part of me hopes that he does this, but you know, he like really runs down that line and sees, but also his character is more action oriented. And he's young and he's, you know, and it's during a time of war. So you may not see that. But Winter's Harvest has a wholly different origin story and history that goes along with it, which will make more sense about now that, you know, Allie's character, Nalishley, who is very young and not fully formed as a, I almost said human, but as a person, she's really going to struggle with that thing. And it's awake now.
There's an ego challenge.
It's awake now because it was kind of half asleep before. So you know, Donnie's always jealous that she gets another attack. Well, it's like
at what cost?
Literally every single time you're leaning on just the weapon, it is not safe anymore.
Yeah, it's like putting a Balrog in a sword, man. And every time you use it, it has a chance to come out and don't care, and you might be the victim, or your friends might be the victim.
Yeah, or whoever your buddy is. Yeah, I mean, it's
I have an idea. So, guys, on this After Dark, I'm gonna be asking Angel some questions that normally we would probably just ask in private, but this isn't critical or super secret. But
sure,
what do you think about this idea? It's just an idea. And guys, if y'all join the spaces, you can actually participate in these sort of discussions and throw out other ideas. Whoever's there, and no matter whether or not you're a viewer, it doesn't matter. What do you think about filming? Like, let's say any given day, you say, you know what, Tatiana, we're gonna film 3 or 4 excerpts of your history or playthrough XYZ, and then whoever, Donnie, for the next 4, or maybe basically make a day of it, right? And figure it out, who do you want to invite to do that? Mm-hmm. And then those excerpts, those 15, 20, let's say we do 10 minutes, and this I have this for a reason. Those 10-minute pre-recorded episodes get inserted during intermission.
That's interesting. That is interesting. It might drive Justin crazy, but that's interesting.
So it's just an idea. I was just thinking, how can you fill in these little flashback or these little episodes of history over time? We've been wanting to figure out how to make sure we have the intermission organic and different. Anyways, you're just an idea I want to throw out there. I'll be curious if what the rest of the gang thinks about
it. That would make it different. That would make it different. One thing that's kind of adjacent to what we've been talking about is if we do another character, like if a character dies and then we're doing another character, I'm definitely want to film all of the backstory, like all of, you know, if at all physically possible,
great.
That backstory, I want to do that.
Ooh, you know? And then we can maybe make that membership only for a little while and then release it later on to the public. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an awesome idea. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Political intrigue is on the menu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's shift into that. You mentioned Randy's character and the Shadow Fox and
being a nasty little
I mean, just a little background, at least for me, Angel. I read my first set of books was David Eddings and like the Pawn series and Queen Sorcery and that had more of just fun, like, you know, grow up and become powerful. It didn't have a lot of political intrigue per se, but my first main introduction that I can really remember about political intrigue, I mean, to like the nth level, is my introduction to The World Darkness and Masquerade, and my participating in that and understanding the court and the systems and the idea of boons and status and just the different mechanisms. Because if you look at the game, so I'll stop there, but definitely if you look at the game between the Age of Tezcatli, guys, by the way, we call it a coterie for a reason, not a party or a fellowship, because it's a bunch of individuals with independent desires that are coordinating together at the time for their own shared causes until there is no shared causes. And then in the fellowship, it's more of a alignment it's a fellowship where they're aligned on a cause. Yeah. So that's my background. I'm curious about your background on how you grew up around that aspect.
So Masquerade, of course, Vampire the Masquerade. And specifically, was it LARP for you? Did you LARP first, Corey, or were you tabletop?
No, LARP. I got introduced. I saw it being played at a convention. I participated. I drank the Kool-Aid, and I never went back.
And you never went back. Yeah, I didn't. LARP was significantly later for me because of how my career went, you know, my gaming career, so to speak, went. Let's see, politically. So I, you know, when I was knee high to a grasshopper, I was bothering my older brother and his friends. Mark Cryer was the very first person I saw GMing something. And I'll tell you what, for a 15-year-old, Mark Cryer, and I was, you know, 8 at the time, I think, he was astonishingly detailed. One of these years, I'm going to have to track him down and like really thank him, because that just he you know, I still to this day I have some of his a couple pages of his notes that he was writing for that, and that was a historical, strongly based historical campaign with high stakes where characters could die. Sound familiar? His level of research, I mean, of course, this is all pre-internet, right? So his level of research of going to the library again as a middle teenager, it's just amazing to me. Like looking back, it's amazing to me. And that just opened my eyes and said, okay, this can be a level of in-depth context that I had never considered before. And then, but I would say the politics, so that continued. And, you know, Corey, I was always trying to world build. I was always pushing it. I've been GMing since I was 8. And I've always just been trying to build other worlds and new frontiers constantly. But it wasn't until I was 17, and I actually had, it was funny, I had actually run into the first edition of the Vampire the Masquerade LARP book. Remember that, the big green one? It was like full sized, you know, it wasn't Laws of the Night yet. And I thought it was intriguing, but it didn't really click for me because I didn't see it. I was a little young and I didn't see it in motion, you know? And I think for a LARP, you have to see it in motion for it.
Oh, you definitely, you just use their watching, shadowing.
So it was, it didn't quite hit. But when I was, 17 and I had this, and I remember reading, I won't, some other time I'll go into detail about the job that I had, which actually was conducive to this. Where I like really needed something to latch onto because it was like mind-numbingly repetitive. Mm-hmm. I read it and I said, you know, this is an incredible world. This is right at the edge of my ability to bring to life, to do justice to, but I think I can do it.
Yeah.
And
wow.
So I studied like maniacally to try to get the history that I was going to need that was implied in all of these, with all of these vampires. I really thought through, okay, how do I portray a 500-year-old, you know, who was there at the fall of Constantinople, et cetera, et cetera. Actually a little.
Wow. By the way, guys, this is the first time I've ever heard this backstory.
Yeah,
so
no, I've never
this
told
is cool.
You, yeah. I've never told you this. And it was really, it was that, you know, freaking vampires, man.
I don't know what it was exactly. I mean, I played like WoW. I mean, that's a gamer, right? So I did all the online game stuff, the MMOs, the Ultima Online, and there was
EVE Online where you were extremely involved with it and built a whole economy. And I mean,
and that was later down the line, but nothing to the level of planning a year to have someone politically like removed, let alone killed off, right? But just like just removed, like decimating their status to the point that you've politically assassinated them, and they're nobody, and which is in a lot of ways a much stronger play than just whacking them,
destroying them, right?
Yeah,
the tabletop game, the tabletop version of Vampire is very different, than a LARP. I mean, it's the same world or a very similar world, but, you know, obviously when you're with a coterie, you're telling the story of that coterie, right?
Yeah.
And then when you're in a LARP, it's really kind of works best. Some people would argue this with me, but it kind of works best when it's player versus player. Now our coterie sometimes did, even in the tabletop game, sometimes did devolve down into player versus player. But you don't want too much of that, even in a vampire game where you can't play with each other.
I mean, you can have some obviously alliances and coteries, which may for a majority of it, but and for a long haul, like especially if you get Bloodbound, and I'm gonna get into all the details behind all that. But yes, overall, it's a small group versus other small groups, mostly. And then how do you gain power and influence, assuming that's what you want to do? There's a lot of things you can do in the game, obviously.
So that was really, Corey, where I would say that I had my political tabletop role-playing awakening. I'm also known for my super long campaigns. That was what, 10 years? Yeah, that was 10 years.
Yeah.
So that was all the way through the military. That was before the military, all the way through the military and after the military. It's about a decade we were running that chronicle.
Yeah. So about a decade. Yeah. One of the interesting things I think people probably haven't seen before, maybe they have, is that with the Age of Tetzcatli, you have empowered players to play NPCs. And while you, Angel, are an individual and can play them, it's different when you have players and the mechanisms that they can come up with, like the Shadow Falcon. You'll see others in the future individually do that within context of the game, but it's not necessarily under all through Angel's lens. And so that's going to be... that's another very interesting way to tell a story. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be this is a very political intrigue based society. So you're going to see some things that normally you don't see in D&D, to be honest, because unless the players are literally just maybe the player base is not necessarily a coterie. I mean, a fellowship, but a coterie game, and like I guess that could be true. And maybe when you look pretty at Curse of Strahd, that might be there, right?
So in Curse of Strahd, it's uniquely possible because of the dark powers and how that world is set up and that adventure setup. It's one of the many reasons why I wanted to do that as our second table. However, generally, and we talked some about this the last episode, you know, we're now kind of in the era of the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
So, and since everybody is a protagonist, that does not include getting screwed over by your fellow protagonists. Like, that's not part of that narrative flow. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's not. I mean, it still happens sometimes, but like, it'd be a very, very rare thing. And it's kind of antithetical to the sort of, you know, collaborative
teamwork.
Everyone is a protagonist, a heroic narrative that fifth edition Dungeons and Dragons sets up. It was much more likely to happen in early editions of D&D, where you have the rogue stealing things, you had the paladin being the moral enforcer, you had all of that going on. But that's really, I almost want to say that's a thing of the past. One of the things that I wanted to highlight was how playing in a more political milieu has allowed Tatiana specifically to just blossom. I mean, I've seen her do things as a player that she had never done before, because this is her first campaign. Remember,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah,
this is it. And like, you can tell she just lights up and thrives when she's playing this darker, more even darker, but more political game, more interpersonal based game. You know, she's a strong player regardless, and she's grown tremendously as we've gone along through the main campaign. But I can just see her. You know, you and I have talked about this many times before. Like, I wish there was a LARP we could bring her to.
When you experience the ability to plot and plan and execute and see things in motion, it's a different adrenaline feeling. It's a different type of food that you're eating that's very delicious, but different than your normal set of food that you eat. So that's kind of how I see it with her. Is she's like, oh my god! And once you taste it, you're like, this is cool, this is great. And because you haven't done it before, obviously you really want to explore that, and so. Given the ability to explore these different scenarios and options and characteristics and goals and tropes, whatever the case may be.
Absolutely. Yeah. There are difficulties running in this, you know, in running political intrigue. I'm going to speak, you know, specifically to D&D here, because of everything that I was outlining before. You know, you have to have, well, I guess this is universal, but you have to have like a lot of trust, because and there are different ways, you know, there are different ways. Alex runs insight deception a little bit differently at his table, and because he really wants to preserve the out of character uncertainty of it. Which I totally get. I think if I was running a home game, I would probably roll both parties myself so that neither person knowed how high they rolled.
Because this is a speed version of it, which is another topic, is that we have to show this in a smaller number of episodes than 100, 200. Normally these are long, year long, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 year long campaigns.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have to do that. And, you also, as we've talked about, before, the pace has to be there. You can't have, like that discussion between Nalishley and Okatla would have, you know, in the home game, you remember, I mean, some of those discussions were hour long, hour and a half long discussions.
Well, they're pivotable. This is character alliance formation or frenemy, you know, formation frenemy, type of things.
Exactly. Yes. No, exactly. I mean, exactly. In a LARP scene, that might be half of your entire evening. When you finally get a chance to speak, quote unquote, alone with a potential ally or a crucial enemy, you remember that, Corey. You could have 2-hour long strolls with these people and just go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth.
I can see how, you know, Etzel, you know, can align with the Shadow Fox on some things, but she doesn't want to get killed, so she has to be careful, and she doesn't want to reveal. Right. So how can she? But that takes time. Usually you're observing, you're watching, you're slowly building up a potential relationship, and have reasons to talk to each other. But he's kind of new in her eyes, other than just knowing the name. So it's a little harder in the fast-paced world. But you have these different alliances that are assisting. Like, you know, if I want to undermine someone, then who do I align with temporarily to do that until that's no longer the alliance is no longer needed, right? And that's kind of what we're talking about here.
Well, and to your point, Randy had told me he's really enjoying playing Shadow Fox because he's taking chances that he would never take as a long form if he was playing a long form character.
That's an interesting trope, because in the LARP setting, Angel, some people would not take chances for 2 years in LARP. I usually was around the 6 month mark. I wanted to make sure that, unfortunately, the way the LARP work, guys, on the spaces, is I want to make sure I had enough actual XP to kind of justify how to grow into my character, essentially. You had to survive. And then once you got to a point where you're relatively kind of your sheet matches who you are and your position and all that stuff, then it's kind of hard to play an elder when you don't have any XP.
You're an elder on paper only.
Ready for delaborate. No, but I would take risks. And because, I mean, at some point, I mean, risk reward, right? This is how it works. And some people would play, you know, would be betas and alphas underneath someone else, who's kind of take, you know, being the head of it, and that's cool. That's fine. I think there's an analogy there with like your main characters. You know, I don't know. I think sometimes people are afraid to take a risk. There's a lot of some people have a huge amount of buy-in into their character, and the loss of that. Loss aversion, right? And loss of that's really bad. But let alone the viewers in the idea of that character dying, even though they may have made appropriate decisions or took appropriate chances. So I guess with NPCs, it's more acceptable.
Much more. I mean, yeah, much more. Again, I'm going to keep, this is just the air we're breathing now in the industry and in the art. You know, to me, it's an art. Most people call it a hobby. But protagonists don't die. Like in Western cinema, which is actually what this is usually compared to as opposed to literature, in Western cinema, unless it's a horror movie, the protagonist usually almost never dies. Or if they do, they die at the very, very end, you know, in the last 3 minutes of the movie. If you are comparing this to a book, they die in the last chapter of the book. They don't, you know, it's almost unthinkable. It's one of the reasons why Psycho, Hitchcock's masterpiece, is a masterpiece, because halfway through the movie, your protagonist dies. You know, that doesn't happen. I mean, that's just like, especially back then, that just doesn't happen. And it was shocking, you know.
Well, maybe we'll have more Game of Thrones where they do kill off the protagonists of the time, right?
Yeah.
Walking Dead or whatever.
And it's no coincidence. It's funny you should say that, because like it's no coincidence that Game of Thrones, that early Game of Thrones was a sensation. It wasn't.
You know what that means, though?
A global sensation.
So the question is this your theory or your stance is protagonist is kind of in the end? My question is. Do we have a rebirth, kind of like fashion, where this actually is very interesting? Everyone is tired of the superhero protagonist, right? Everyone doesn't die thing, and now they're actually more interested. So I'd be curious if actually our viewers and people in general are very interested in seeing a more human based, more, I don't say realistic, grounded, and people actually taking chances versus, you know, the protagonist cannot die scenario. So I don't know.
I mean, it's right. There's a lot I could say about that, but I mean, I'll note that like, it can be very, I understand why viewing the characters, viewing the party, as protagonists is attractive. Like I see that clearly. Nobody wants their character to die. Who's a serious role player. Nobody wants their character to die. You know, you want the happy ending. You invest an ungodly amount of hours into these characters as compared to a video game character, which I would argue, you can never get as invested in, really, because you're not controlling every facet of that character. You're going along. I don't know. The closest that I've seen is something like Mass Effect, the Mass Effect trilogy, which is, you know, incredible. And I love, thank you, Toby, for introducing me to that. But even still, I mean, just you're living that character, you're breathing that character, and you might be playing this character for hundreds and hundreds of hours. I mean, fuck me, in a long running campaign, you might have played that character 1,000 hours, Corey.
Oh yeah, a ton.
Six hour long set. Like back in the day, we do 6 hour long sessions, 7 hour long sessions. You know, I mean, it'd be like a day. You know, it'd be most of the day. Sometimes even longer. We'd break for break for lunch or something and, you know, relax and then come back. I mean, you might crack 1,000 hours on these characters and it's not, and there's nothing preordained or prescripted about it. It's all you.
No. And it sucks if your story ends before you get to tell certain things, but on the other hand, it's a story nonetheless.
It's a story and it's still greater. I mean, exactly. It's still part of the greater. I've always, I don't know, maybe for 20 years now, at least I've thought about it as a chorus. And certain voices come in at certain times, and then certain voices leave at other times. And sometimes the song of the individual voice is very long, and sometimes it's not. You know, I think I've already, this isn't making news, like for characters who survive all of campaign one, and if they want to continue to play these characters, I will allow them to play these characters for campaign two. Right. So there could be some very long songs indeed. Or there could be like, no, I've told the story that I want to tell with these characters. I want to do something different. That's perfectly fine. You know, and I would never punish somebody for that. We're swimming against the stream, my friend. You know, like we're in that way, we're swimming against the stream. I think, who is it?
From a viewer standpoint or from a player standpoint, do you think that viewers would be more accepting with the Game of Thrones style these days?
From a genre standpoint.
Oh, genre. Okay.
We're swimming against stream because we're in the era of the protagonist. I think that for the people, I think there are definite. I mean, you know, look at how successful Game of Thrones was. There are definitely many people out there who will find the kind of story that we are telling more intriguing than if you know that there's just kind of this unspoken rule that the characters don't die, or maybe one person in the entire campaign dies, or you know, like
maybe we're the trailblazers, maybe the era of Coatl is now okay. The protagonist is descending, and ascending is this new idea of this sort of play style within D&D because it aligns to a Game of Thrones or style. I don't know. Maybe there's room for this and maybe it'll grow.
The last thing I'll say, before I scurry off, Corey.
Yes.
Cause I just looked at the time.
Four minutes here.
Is that, I do have, you know, if things go to shit, I do have a what happens after TPK for the party in case so many characters die or all the characters die and there's just no way that we could, and there's no way that we could continue with the current, you know, with the current trajectory, then I gotta stray for that too, because the greater story continues on.
Well, there's plenty of places in the world that we haven't introduced or you haven't introduced, and there's plenty of things going on. Even if Jerimentum, if the dream lives or dies, there's still plenty of other people wanting to do stuff.
Lives or dies, absolutely.
All right. It was great talking to you, and for those who are listening afterwards, appreciate any comments around any of this, and especially around, do you think that the political intrigue is something that might be of interest to you, or would you like the idea of the protagonist living and sort of wanting to try to hold that to the best possible without obviously ruining integrity of the story and all that stuff. But in any case,
for sure.
All right, and now we're off to Angel off has to his After Dark YouTube edition from 7 to 8, where it's a different format. And so please, if you're listening to this, definitely come over there during Fridays between 7 and 8 and listen to what's going on over there too and participate.
Give us a look. All right, thanks so much, Corey, for hosting. Appreciate it.
Thank you for being a great guest speaker.
Yay! All right, take care.
Take care.
Bye bye.